Bank. The so-called E1 plan includes the construction of thousands of new settler units on Palestinian land between East Al-Quds and the settlement of Ma'ale Adumim. The move has sparked widespread international condemnation. Numerous countries and human rights organizations have called the plan a violation of international law. The E1 plan is considered one of the most dangerous settlement projects in the occupied West Bank. Its goal is to encircle Palestinian towns east of the occupied Al-Quds and prevent their expansion eastwards. It also aims to crush the possibility of Al-Quds being the capital of any future Palestinian state by severing the northern and southern parts of the West Bank, effectively eliminating its geographic continuity. The E1 plan covers 1,200 hectares of confiscated Palestinian land and connects Ma'ale Adumim settlement to the occupied Al-Quds. Political analyst Bruno Biccolini says it is very urgent for the international community to act quickly to save the Palestinian people and land from Israel's acts of aggression.
This is not something new. What is new is the gigantic movement being organized by Netanyahu, Trump, and their finances that want to spread speculative real estate from all over Al-Quds, and not only in agricultural areas or peasants' areas. They want to transform the original population of Al-Quds into a Bantustan, into a ghetto, organizing Al-Quds like what they have been done to the area C of the West Bank. If we go back on 2002 or 2001, this was the last moment of hope to implement the so-called Oslo Agreement. The Zionists, they never wanted to establish a two-state solution, besides being the ones who stole the majority of land and water.
Staying with the occupied West Bank, five young Palestinians have been injured during an Israeli raid on a village near Ramallah. To hear more about the raid, we are now joined by our West Bank correspondent, Naka Hamed. Naka, very good to have you on the program. What can you tell us about these latest developments?
Yes, Bevan, well, the Israeli forces seems to have their efforts distributed all over the West Bank for the last 12 hours. The majority of the Palestinian cities have been raided, with one major raid and a military operation towards Tul Kerem city. Let me start from there, as it is the main theater of events now. Just a little less than 1 hour, the Israeli forces announced that they have ended a 24-hour military operation towards Tul Kerem, where the entire city was put under a curfew, was put under total siege. Closing of all entrances and exits towards Tul Kerem. More than 1,000 Palestinians have been detained throughout the night, and this came after as a group punishment to what happened yesterday with a Palestinian resistance operation took place when the Palestinian resistance groups blew up a local made bomb to a military vehicle near the checkpoint 104 checkpoint near the city of Tul Kerem. And now the Israeli forces have announced that they will be ending this operation and withdrawing from Tul Kerem city after committing all of these actions on all of these measurements inside the city, and making the life going back slowly towards Tul Kerem, with keeping the entrances and exits closed. Just they will be withdrawing from inside the city. Coming over here towards Ramallah, four young Palestinians have been shot with live ammunition after an Israeli settler attack towards the village of Deir Jarir to the northeast of Ramallah. Those four Palestinians were shot by the Israeli settlers and the Israeli forces as they were raiding the village. And this village had been under systematic attacks by the Israeli settlers, usually backed by the IOF and backed by the Israeli police in that area, because settlers are trying so hard to expand on the expense of the Palestinian lands and on the Palestinian villages, especially in the area of the northeast, the villages of Ramallah, Deir Jarir, Kufr Malik, Al Mughayr, Turmusayya, Abu Falah, all under the same attack and all are facing the same atrocities. If we are to stay in northeast of Ramallah, the Israeli settlers have also attacked the village of Sinjar. This is a name that we are repeatedly talking about because extremely dire situation is being created over there by the Israeli settlers who are trying as much as they can to seize more Palestinian land. The village of Sinjar owned 40,000 dunams of land and now it has been reduced towards 8,000 only. So we are talking about almost 70% of land loss in that area to the settlement expansion and to the settler violence over there. Throughout the night, also the Israeli forces have raided the village of Kufar Aqab to the south of Ramallah, between Ramallah and occupied Al-Quds and the village of Kufar Ni'mah to the west of Ramallah, firing live ammunition and arresting many Palestinians. If we are also to take close to Ramallah, to the east of Ramallah, the Israeli forces started a wide range raid towards the village of Bitin under the pretense that they were...
Nako, the connection is getting a little unstable. Let me get back to you in our later news bulletins. We're going to get back to the regular course of the news. That was Nako Ahmed joining us from Ramallah. Yemenis have once again held a mass rally in the northern city of Saada to reaffirm their solidarity with Palestinians and condemn the repeated Israeli attacks against their country. The demonstrators carried Yemeni and Palestinian flags and chanted slogans in condemnation of the Israeli crimes in Gaza, as well as the aggression against Yemen. They also expressed support for the Yemeni armed forces for their anti-Israeli operations. Yemenis have been holding pro-Palestine rallies almost every Friday since the beginning of the genocide in Gaza in October 2023. At a festival on Palestinian culture held in Rome, Italy's former Prime Minister Massimo D'Alema urged the EU to immediately suspend the bloc's cooperation agreement with Israel. Italy has said it is ready to consider sanctions on the regime as proposed by the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen.
A new edition of the Palestine Festival, a five-day initiative focusing on Palestinian culture, has kicked off in the Italian capital, Rome. The festival, which is drawing large crowds, features Palestinian book, handcraft and culture. This year's edition includes talks and roundtables on a number of issues, including how the youth perceive the Palestinian plight and the complicity of Western countries in the Israeli regime's genocidal operations in Gaza and the West Bank. On Thursday, the festival was also joined by Italy's former Prime Minister Massimo D'Alema, who held an interview on the ongoing dramatic situation in the occupied territories and grave violations of international norms carried out by Israel.
It seems to me that finally, albeit with far too much delay, we are starting to understand we are facing an intolerable situation in the Palestinian territories. Nonetheless, nothing is done to stop it. Palestinians have the right to self-defense when somebody breaks into your house and kills you.
Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani said on Thursday that the Italian government is ready to consider sanctions on Israel proposed by European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen in her State of the Union speech. The bloc is set to adopt a tougher stance on the regime, including imposing sanctions on extremist ministers and violent settlers, and suspending bilateral payments to the Tel Aviv regime over the unfolding humanitarian crisis in Gaza. More than 300 former European diplomats and officials have written to European Union leaders urging a far more decisive response to Israel's onslaught in the occupied territories. Unlike some European countries, however, the Italian Foreign Minister Tajani has once again stated that Rome is not ready to recognize the state of Palestine yet. Max Civili, Rome.
Iran has issued a serious warning to the European parties to the 2015 nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says any activation of the deal's so-called snapback mechanism would automatically nullify Iran's recent agreement with the UN nuclear watchdog to resume inspections of Iranian nuclear sites.
The validity of this agreement stands only as long as no hostile action is taken against the Islamic Republic of Iran, including activation of the snapback mechanism. If, despite all the disputes at the Security Council, the snapback is ultimately triggered, then from our perspective, this agreement will no longer hold any legitimacy.
Araghchi was referring to the 2015 agreement's dispute resolution clause that allows for reimposition of UN sanctions on Iran. European parties to the deal triggered the mechanism last month. Araghchi said Iran, along with Russia and China, believes that Europe has no legal basis to activate the mechanism. He said Iran's recent agreement with the IAEA on a new cooperation framework has nothing to do with the snapback mechanism. Araghchi added that under the deal, the IAEA cannot carry out inspections or access Iran's enriched uranium stockpiles until the country's security concerns are fully addressed. He said granting such access requires authorization of the Supreme National Security Council on a case-by-case basis. The Iranian foreign minister says Tehran is close to reach a deal with Paris that will release Iranian female academic Mahdi Esfandiari, who's held in a prison in France. Abbas Araghchi said a lot of activities have been done in this regard, adding that Esfandiari's release in exchange for French prisoners in Iran is now approaching its final stages. The top Iranian diplomat didn't give a time frame for the exchange, saying Iran's judiciary and security institutions are also involved in the process. He added that there will be final coordination for implementation of the deal between Tehran and Paris. Esfandiari has been held in a detention facility in Paris suburbs since late February. She was arrested over publishing a message condemning the genocide in Gaza. Esfandiari is a linguist and French language graduate who has lived in France for the past 8 years. The UN Security Council has condemned Israel's deadly airstrikes on the Qatari capital Doha, which were aimed at assassinating senior Hamas officials. Qatar's delegation, led by its prime minister, denounced Israel's aggression as an attempt to derail Gaza's ceasefire mediation efforts.
The attack is a violation of the sovereignty of a state member of the United Nations. This attack is far away of the civilized behavior by states that believe in peace. Qatar is making tireless efforts to save lives, and this attack puts the international community before a test. Israel, led by extremists, bloodthirsty extremists, have gone beyond any borders.
During the Wednesday meeting, Sheikh Mohammed Al-Thani accused Israel of recklessly undermining regional stability and attempting to sabotage any prospects for peace. He stressed that Doha will continue its humanitarian diplomatic efforts to spare bloodshed, warning that it will not tolerate further violations of its security and sovereignty. He added that the Security Council bears a historic responsibility now, cautioning that silence in the face of Israeli crimes will erode its credibility. Russia and China likewise addressed the meeting, condemning the strikes on Qatar and voicing concern that such actions could trigger a new wave of regional escalation.
The Russian Federation condemns in no uncertain terms the attack carried out by Israel on 9 September, targeting a residential compound in Doha. It is clear that this Israeli attack will have grave consequences, both for the already atrocious situation in Gaza and for the security of the vast region of the Middle East.
Israel launched an attack on Doha, the capital of Qatar, in flagrant violation of Qatar's territorial sovereignty and national security, international law and the UN Charter, and efforts to achieve peace. China resolutely opposes this and strongly condemns such an act.
Both Russian and Chinese delegations criticized the impunity granted to Israel by the West, particularly the US. Russia's ambassador Vasily Nebenzia said the Israeli strikes targeted not only the state of Qatar, but also the mediators working towards a diplomatic solution to the Gaza war. He urged Israel to halt what he called reckless acts of aggression that fuel regional violence. China's Fu Kong likewise condemned Israel's Doha strikes as irresponsible and a deliberate attempt to sabotage Gaza ceasefire negotiations, which can heighten tensions in the region. Foo called on Israel to cease hostilities and return to the negotiating table. Iran's permanent representative to the UN also firmly condemned the recent Israeli strike against Qatar, warning that inaction by the world body will lead to further aggression by Tel Aviv.
The criminal Israeli prime minister has openly threatened the countries in the region with attacks and has explicitly declared wherever Hamas political leaders are present, the regime will attack them. If the United Nations Security Council does not take actions today, another country will inevitably be added to the list of the Israeli regime's aggression, and the regime will once again commit aggressive acts with complete impunity.
The Iranian envoy urged the UN to adopt a binding resolution to hold the Israeli regime fully accountable for its violation of the Qatari sovereignty. He said Tehran supports Qatar's right to self-defense based on international law and the UN Charter. He underlined that Doha reserves the right to take political, diplomatic, and legal measures to protect Qatari citizens' sovereignty and territorial integrity. The emergency meeting of the Security Council came less than a week after the Israeli regime launched an organized assassination attack against Hamas officials in the Qatari capital, Doha. The attack left 6 fatalities, but failed to kill the senior officials of the Palestinian resistance movement. And that is a wrap for this hour's news bulletin. Thank you so much for staying with us.
She's the love of my life, does everything with a smile. She's my mother, my sweet mother. She can take the pain away with just one look. That's my mother, my sweet mother. You're the picture in the frame with all the colors of the rainbow. I'm far from ashamed to say I love you so. It's late, but I can't sleep tonight. Forgive me if I take my time, but I just have to let you know you're so special. She taught me how to pray. We play games every day with my mother, my sweet mother. Even if I made no sense, listen with patience, that's my mother, my sweet mother. She would sing a sweet song till I shut my eyes and kiss my head and say goodnight. And I feel safe with you by my side. You're there for every step in my life. I'm sorry. You know, you're so precious. If only this was true. I'm in a cold, dark, wet room. I was an orphan, and now I'm 22. I've never known my mom. A picture faded by the sun is all I have. Left alone with nothing more but what I am. It's not enough, this life is tough when there's no one to call my mother, my sweet mother, my sweet mother.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life. a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of RIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Mahdi Rastani.
Every one of our imams was dealing with a different era and a different situation. The time of the sixth imam was very unique and it is very special for us, mainly because if you were to look at the time of the sixth imam, you would find many commonalities between his time and the times that we are going through and the times that we are living through. It was not a time of open oppression. People had the ability to practice their faith. It was not like the time of the Prophet early on in Mecca. At the same time, there was hidden forms of oppression. You find in the time of the sixth imam, there are still many times where the imam is worried and cautious about what he teaches to his companions. In the midst of all of this, the sixth imam utilized this opportunity and this switch from the time of Bani Umayyad to the time of Bani al-Abbas to promote the teachings of the Shia school of thought. One thing that you will notice in Islamic history as you go from the first dynasty to the second dynasty, when you go from the time of Bani Umayyah to the time of Bani al-Abbas, is that you find Bani Umayyah were not fans of knowledge. They were not fans of teaching and preaching. They were not fans of libraries. They were not fans of universities. Bani al-Abbas, on the other hand, were the exact opposite. Though they had their own wrong intentions, they were big fans of knowledge, of debates, of libraries, and of universities. And the sixth imam utilized this opportunity and this openness that he had been afforded to preach the teachings of the Shia school of thought. But make no mistake, because the reality is, if you want to teach a particular school of thought, there have to be those who will accept and receive that knowledge from you. And this is where the students of the sixth imam, or if I use a better term, the disciples of the sixth imam, come into the picture. Because not everyone who came and sat in a gathering where the sixth imam was preaching was at the same level in terms of his acceptance of what the sixth imam was teaching. There were those who simply came to see what he had to say. They saw him as a scholar amongst other scholars. Then you had disciples. They came to fundamentally accept and receive what he is preaching. Tonight, inshallah, we want to delve into the lives of disciples of the sixth imam and see what lessons we can learn from the personal lives of these individuals. The first of those individuals that we find in the life of the sixth imam is Zurara ibn A'yan al-Kufi. The name of Zurara occurs in 3,000 narrations. Now, it's a sad reality that when we mention these names, and I speak of myself, for many of the Shia, these names are not even familiar. Ask a Shi'i if he knows Bukhari and Muslim. He definitely knows Bukhari and Muslim, doesn't he? He knows Tirmidhi too. He knows this, he knows that. Ask him if he knows who Zurara is. All of us say, I don't know who Zurara is. But he narrated 3,000 narrations. Yeah, but we don't take time to even understand who this individual is, yes? Zurara ibn A'yan al-Kufi. He came from a family called the family of Ali A'yan. This family, top-notch family. You know some families, you see them. From that family come scientists, engineers, amazing people. This is how Ali A'yan were. Zurara had a very special status in the eyes of the Ahlul Bayt. Why? How did he reach this status that the fifth imam and sixth imam constantly used to speak about him? They constantly used to praise him. They constantly used to protect him from threats and dangers that were coming his way. Because Zurara was not the type of person who would just sit there and look at the sixth imam and see what he says and say, okay, inshallah, if I remember this, I'll pass this on. This is not how he narrated hadith. How did he reach that status? This is how he did it. Zurara had a couple of important characteristics. The most important of all was work ethic. What Zurara did, whatever he did it in the best possible way. He's going to narrate hadith, but he wants to protect this hadith. He wants to pass it on for generations. He wants to leave a heritage for the Shia. So Zurara was the type of person, though he was in Kufa, he was from Kufa. Kufa is in today's Iraq, yes? And the imam most of the time was where? In Medina, in today's Arabia. Yes? How far of a distance that is. That's a very far distance. But Zurara would put on and take on the burden of traveling from Kufa all the way to where? To Medina, to hear hadith directly from the lips of the sixth imam. This is what made him so special. The sacrifices that he made on the way. So there were those who would stay in Kufa. They would wait for people to come back from Medina and share what the sixth imam was preaching. Yes? That's why the narration says, at one point, if you entered into the masjid of Kufa, 900 people would be there, sitting there, saying, Haddathani Ja'far ibn Muhammad. I heard this from who? From Ja'far ibn Muhammad. There were many people who were quoting from the imam. But then there was Zurara who wouldn't sit in Kufa. There was Zurara who was to do this in the best way possible. I'm going to go to the imam. I'm going to sit in front of the imam myself. This is characteristic number one. This is why he had that type of status. Because of this work ethic. Number two, what else did Zurara do? When others came to hear the sixth imam, they came. What did they come with? They come with their ears. But Zurara didn't used to come with his ears. Zurara used to come with his writing material. That makes a world of difference. A world of difference. So the narration says when Zurara used to come and he used to be in the presence of the sixth imam, immediately he's taking notes. Now, you have to understand that at that time, paper is still not a thing. Maybe 50 years, 100 years later, paper becomes a more dominant thing in that part of the world. Yes? Still, paper is not a thing. What are they using? They're using parchments. That's animal skin. They're using maybe papyrus. Maybe they're using animal bones. Maybe they're using stones, tablets, these types of things. So you imagine the work ethic of someone who wants to come and sit in front of the sixth imam, says, I have to write it. Writing is not easy. That's not a simple thing. But this is what helped Zurara reach that point where the fifth imam and the sixth imam constantly used to pray for Zurara. Yes? And when threats were coming the direction of Zurara, the fifth and sixth imam would do things to protect him from that threat. The lesson to be learned from Zurara is the work ethic that Zurara had. We move on to the second companion, Humran ibn A'yan, the brother of Zurara. We don't know as much about Humran as we do about Zurara, and there is a reason for that. Because Humran played a role slightly different from the role of Zurara. Zurara's role was to narrate hadith from the sixth imam. What is the sixth imam preaching? I will take that and share that in other cities, mainly in Kufa, which was the main stronghold of the Shia at that time. Humran's role, slightly different. Humran was more of a logistics guy. He played the role of a wakil. That means if someone needs to get money to the sixth imam, he's going to play that role. If someone has to write a letter to the sixth imam, he's going to play that role. If the sixth imam wants to get a message to his followers, he's going to do it through who? He's going to do it through his wakil, through these deputies and these representatives, yes? But interestingly enough, every time people used to come to Hajj, and the imam used to see his own companions, he would ask about who? He would ask about Humran ibn A'yan. So when people used to come to Hajj, the imam used to ask him, do you have any news of Humran? What's going on with Humran? Is his family doing well? Is he doing well? They say, yes, Yabna Rasulullah, he's doing well. He said, when you go back, send my salam to Humran. Interesting, huh? Two children, yes, two brothers. Same family, amazing family. Each one of them played their own role. None of them ever came and said, why am I not doing what he's doing? How come he gets to write hadith? I want to write hadith too. How come he's doing logistics? No, everybody understood their own role. The obedience that they had to the sixth imam. If it wasn't for obedience like this, we wouldn't have a school of thought today. We wouldn't have a hadith corpus today. You understand this? The lesson from Humran is, understand your role and play that role well. Every single one of us has their own role to play. It's wrong for me to sit there and say, no, I don't want this role. I want that role. But you're not good at that role. So why don't you help in this role? No. I want that role. See, now you're creating problems. Now, every one of these individuals, obedience to the sixth imam. This is the lesson from the life of Humran.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حالي حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيم وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Omdurman woke up today to the sounds of heavy explosions as waves of suicidal drones targeted strategic sites across the capital. The Sudanese armed forces confirmed their defenses at Wadi Sayyidna military base intercepted several of the drones, while others struck key power stations in Al-Marhiyat, Al-Jaili, and southern Khartoum. The attacks triggered widespread blackouts in parts of the capital, though no casualties or structural damage have been reported.
This move is predictable. They are under severe pressure, and they are trying to shift the focus of the conflict. The recent returns to Khartoum and high-profile visits by leaders and officials have caught them off guard.
Soon after, the so-called Ta'sis government issued a statement claiming responsibility. While portraying the strikes as targeted against military sites, their claims stand in sharp contrast to the reality on the ground, where civilian infrastructure, such as power stations, were clearly hit. Observers say the statement is an attempt to cast themselves as a political authority rather than a militia, undermining basic services and worsening humanitarian suffering.
They are trying to halt the army, thinking such moves could disrupt its operations, but they will have no impact. The army is advancing according to a well-planned strategy, and these drone attacks are nothing more than desperate acts.
Analysts note the timing is political, aimed at deflecting from RSF setbacks in Kordofan and framing Ta'sis as a rival government. For Sudan's authorities, these strikes underscore the militia's disregard for civilian needs, but the army says it remains firmly in control of the capital.
After a morning of explosions and smoke, Khartoum has stabilized by afternoon. Today's drone attack left outages, but crucially, no casualties. Abdullah Hussein, Khartoum.
Stories published by some Italian newspapers early this week about several groups of Israeli soldiers taking holidays in popular Italian seaside destinations have sparked political outcry in the country. Hundreds of soldiers belonging to the Israeli forces have been seen spending their holiday in luxury premises and hotels in the Marche region and on the island of Sardinia, resting and relaxing after having participated in Israel's genocidal operations in Gaza. The off-duty soldiers were allegedly escorted by Italian police during their period of rest.
What's happened over the past weeks with Israeli soldiers on a period of rest or decompression at our resorts after having committed war crimes is unacceptable. As Spain imposes entry ban on Israel's ministers, Italy not only provides luxury accommodation to the Israeli soldiers, but it even provides police escort services. It's the evidence of the Italian government's complicity with Israel.
Some Israeli soldiers who have refused to join the genocidal operations in Gaza have been jailed for their decision. This drift is taking us nowhere good. History will be the judge.
In Sardinia, pro-Palestinian groups have voiced their opposition to the presence of the Israeli soldiers, with some activists declaring, "We don't want war criminals on our island."
Meanwhile, a group of professionals from the Lazio Region Journalist Association gathered in central Rome, not far from Italy's government building, to hold a commemorative event for all Palestinian journalists who have so far been murdered by Israel in Gaza. The names of all the 250 slain journalists and media workers are being read out by the Italian colleagues.
Read out the names of the slain journalists in Gaza reminds us that a propaganda war is also in place, with Israel doing what it wants with the complicity of several Western states. Israel's deliberate strategy of murdering journalists is aimed at controlling the information coming out from Gaza.
The initiative was held as a national pro-Palestine demonstration is set to take place in the Italian capital, Rome, in early October. Max Civili, Rome.
The resolution introduced by the Islamic Republic of Iran to the Organization of Islamic Cooperation entitled "The Commemoration of the 1500th Anniversary of the Birth of Prophet Muhammad" highlights the Prophet Muhammad as a prophet of mercy whose life embodied compassion, justice, and human dignity.
This declaration is not merely a marker of time. It is a call to reflection, to unity, and to renewed commitment to the noble values embodied by the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. This is not the time for division. It's the time for unity. The challenges we face demand nothing less than unwavering solidarity and support.
Ambassadors from many Muslim countries like Lebanon, Oman, Pakistan and Afghanistan, as well as former ministers from Austria, attended the event. Apart from diplomats and politicians, religious and academic figures also took part in the ceremony, which featured an exhibition of the Holy Quran, traditional music and prayers.
The Prophet is an example for, is a mercy for all of mankind, not only for the believers, but believers and non-believers, Christians, everybody. Faithful.
Iranian Ambassador Eshrak Chahomi stressed the enormous importance of the Year of Mercy as the world witnesses the genocide in Gaza.
Most pressing issue at the time is the issue of Palestine and the genocide which is going on in Gaza Strip, which is deplorable. And indeed, the Islamic Ummah should come together with a unified position, condemn such atrocities by the Israelis against the Palestinian people.
800,000 Muslims live in Austria. This is 8% of the entire population, which makes them the largest minority in the country. The birth anniversary
is an opportunity to translate the values and the memory of Prophet Mohammed into practical dialogue across cultures and society. Dieter Reinisch from Vienna.
In Palestine, the school year began this week with more anxiety than celebration. Instead of focusing on books and lessons, families worry whether their children will return home safely. Military raids, arrests, and checkpoints stand between students and their classrooms. For many, even the schools themselves are in danger. In Assawiya village, a school sits under a cloud of uncertainty after Israeli lawmaker Zvi Scott from the Religious Zionism Party incited for its demolition, portraying children's education as a threat to settlers.
Recently, we were shocked to see a Knesset member inciting against our school, which stands as proof of the Palestinian people's right to this land. This secondary school was founded in 1944 and serves three nearby villages. Like so many Palestinian schools, it is under constant threat from the Israeli occupation, motivated by land seizure and an effort to obstruct education.
Teachers and students say they face daily harassment, from military checkpoints and raids to the fear of demolition. For students, the start of a new school year is meant to be filled with hope and learning. But here under occupation, the daily presence of the army turns education into a struggle for survival. Fear, checkpoints, and military raids seep into classrooms, disrupting the very right to learn.
The situation here is very difficult. We never know if we'll make it to class or be turned back. The army's presence creates fear and tension, making it hard to focus during lessons or exams. Many times, soldiers come into the school, and for weeks, they've tried to take over our building.
When we're at school, there's no sense of safety. Even during breaks, we're denied the chance to go outside. In sports class, if the ball goes beyond the gate, we can't get it back. We live in fear because soldiers surround us with weapons while we have nothing. But this school was here before them, older than their entire history, and that's why they want to erase it.
Education has long been a form of resistance, a way to preserve identity and hope despite occupation. But as Israel intensifies restrictions and incitements against schools, parents and children alike fear that the right to learn is being systematically stripped away. Here inside the school, the desks and chalkboards tell a simple story. Children just want to learn. Yet for Palestinian students, even classrooms are treated as battlegrounds. As this school year begins, their resilience is tested once again amid Israeli violence. Naqa Ahmed, Occupied West Bank.
Sudan is reeling from a humanitarian crisis caused by military clashes inside the country. WHO Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus delivered his remarks on the situation in Sudan this Saturday. He warned that famine is already confirmed in parts of the country, with over 770,000 children expected to suffer from acute malnutrition this year, alongside a nationwide cholera outbreak.
More than 260,000 people need urgent health assistance. 35 health facilities have been destroyed. There are 5,000 suspected cholera cases and 98 deaths. 130,000 children are suffering from malnutrition.
The crisis is most severe in North Darfur, where the paramilitary rapid support forces have maintained a siege since May 2024. Local doctors report that over the past week, RSF artillery strikes killed at least 18 civilians and wounded more than 100 others. Despite international pledges, the RSF continues to block humanitarian aid, leaving the population increasingly vulnerable.
As an organization, we have delivered medical aid to more than 11 health centers in Darfur, including Kelma Camp, the largest displacement camp, now facing a severe cholera outbreak with around 700 cases and 40 deaths. Across Darfur, infections exceeded 10,500.
The UN recently described Sudan as facing the world's largest hunger crisis, with aid deliveries severely constrained by insecurity and RSF blockades. In Al-Fashir and North Darfur, families remain trapped, struggling for food, clean water, and medical care. Local organizations are stepping in with what little they have,
distributing food and basic necessities to curb the spread of cholera. Families in El Fasher endure RSF siege, where cholera spreads and children are facing severe malnutrition. Survival depends on aid breaking through the blockade, because this war is now fought not just with weapons, but with hunger. Abdullah Hussein, Khartoum.
Mohammed has once again topped the list of names for newborn boys in the UK. The Muslim community here say they are thrilled.
Honestly, as a Muslim, I'm so proud. Mohammed's name is the number one, not just in the UK, in the whole world.
Data from the Office for National Statistics confirms that for the second year running, the Prophet of Islam's name with this spelling was the most popular choice for boys. That's over 5,700 newborn boys in England and Wales in 2024, firmly overtaking the previous favorites, Noah and Oliver.
Since the events of October 7, 2023, British Muslims have faced an unprecedented rise in the number of attacks and incidents of abuse. Having a Muslim-sounding name can expose individuals to discrimination, and yet none of that appears to have had any impact on the appeal of the Prophet's name among the parents here.
This is not new. Muhammad has been in the top 10 names for baby boys in Britain since 2016, and parents naming their boys after him goes back a long time.
The character of the Prophet, peace be upon him, as a mercy to the whole creation, and as a role model to sort of address the needs and aspiration of us as Muslims and everybody else, indeed is the reason that people name their children, because they name their children because they want to promote that character.
A character that's needed today more than ever.
Because of the genocide, because of the selfishness that the world is going, because of the way that we are ignoring even our environment and everything else.
And while some say the trend is not always faith-driven, that pop culture and famous sports personalities of the same name may also play their part, others say in the end it all boils down to Prophet Muhammad himself.
We think about the Prophet first. This is the main reason people putting their names afterward. And after that, it's the celebrities or any other names you can consider it off. But for me as a believer, I would say that it's just my love with my Prophet.
Other Islamic boy names, Yusuf and Yahya among them, have also risen in the rankings compared with last year, reinforcing the belief that Islam is not only the UK's, but the world's fastest growing religion. Saeed Pariza, London.
Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints. The birthday of Muhammad, peace be upon him and his progeny, marks the greatest celebration in history, 2016. Imam Khamenei. Among the stars that you see, there are some which are galaxies and are thousands of times larger than the one we see in summer nights. A galaxy is a collection of thousands of solar systems and suns. The Holy Prophet was like a galaxy, and he had thousands of virtues which shone brightly like a star. In him, knowledge is accompanied by morality. Government is accompanied by wisdom. Worshipping God is accompanied by serving people. Jihad is accompanied by mercy. Love of God is accompanied by love of his creatures. Pride is accompanied by modesty. Being up to date is accompanied by foresight. Honesty is accompanied by complexity. In political matters, attention to God is accompanied by attention to peace and health. Attention to worldly matters is accompanied by attention to spiritual matters, and pursuing divine goals is accompanied by pursuing human goals. He is a perfect example of a human being, and God Almighty has not created a person who is as perfect as him. And he is a bearer of good news, and he is a warner. He knows what all humanity is doing, and he knows everything that happens in history. He is the person who invites all humanity to get close to God, and he is a shining beacon of guidance for humanity. Surely we have sent you as a witness, and as a bearer of good news, and as a warner, and as one inviting to Allah by his permission, and as a light-giving torch. The Holy Quran, chapter 33, verses 45 and 46. Under the Prophet's rule, Muslims reached the peak of global civilizations. The Holy Prophet ﷺ carried the message of knowledge, yet there was no knowledge in that society. He carried the message of justice, yet there was no trace of justice in that society, and powerful people and bullying rulers dominated people's lives and possessions. He was the messenger of morality, lenience, forgiveness, justice, and kindness, yet that society was devoid of such characteristics in the real sense of the word. The society was full of unkind, bullying, immoral, ignorant, and prejudiced people who were unjustifiably arrogant and who had their hearts set on carnal desires. It was in such tough and fanatic conditions and in such a dry desert that the Holy Prophet ﷺ grew up. And this 13-year period finally ended in the establishment of the Prophet's rule. He formed a community on the basis of monotheism, knowledge, justice, morality, ethics, and generosity.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, to Iran Radio, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, broadcasting from the heart of our capital, Tehran. To begin, we invite you to stay with us for today's special, a daily program dedicated to commemorating various Islamic and Iranian occasions with a blend of beautiful Quranic verses, heartfelt prayers, uplifting nasheeds, and insightful reports. This show creates a space for reflection and connection. Don't miss the opportunity to join us in this spiritual journey. After that, take a moment to immerse yourself in Hadith of the Day. Every day, Sheikh Muhammad Ja'far Danish will present a fresh Hadith from the Holy Prophet and his noble family, peace be upon them. Along with each Hadith, he will offer brief yet thought-provoking commentary that resonate with our lives, often aligned with key dates on the Islamic or solar calendar. It is a chance to reflect and renew your spirit. Next, we've prepared a selection of some of our finest radio productions filled with stories and soundscapes designed to enrich your day. For those seeking a deeper connection with the Holy Quran, don't go anywhere. Let's recite the Quran with Mr. Habibullah Fasizadeh. This program focuses on enhancing your Quranic recitation skills at level 2. So stay with us for the journey ahead as today's special is coming up next.